Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. I have to decide whether the gain's going to work here. Gain. How's that? Better? All right, so actually what I'd like to do is to start out, so first I'm going to tell you a little bit about the presentation. So I sent out an email. I made groups. The vast majority of you got the number one choice in your group. Not everybody, because I have to get some evenness in the size of the groups. There are three of you who never gave me any preferences, and I had emailed you yesterday, and I need to hear what you want to do. Okay, so some of you didn't get what you want. You will have some freedom. I mean, you did close, so you got the number two. I think maybe one person got a number three choice or something like that. So the reasons you may not have gotten your choices were usually that there was nobody else who wanted that, and I needed to make a group that had some size. So I basically took the six topics that had the most students interested in doing them, and let those be the core for the groups. And then if you had a secondary topic choice, if you weren't in one of those six and you had a secondary topic choice that was one of those, that's where you got put. So that was typically the thing. And there were a couple of people who had none of those six topics, and I asked them for their choices. So most people got what they want. We were actually having a discussion up here at the start of class. You have a lot of freedom to now make this what you want it to be as a group, and it is. I'll hand you out criteria for how this is going to work, but basically your classmates will give you a score of 0 to 5, 5 being high, using criteria of did they learn something from it, was it relevant, was there actually physics involved, how was the presentation in terms of technically, was it smooth? Was it organized? Could they get anything out of it? So entertainment, maybe even a piece of it, but some degree of coherence. What you do not want to do is have, for a group of six students, have six different little sub-presentations up here. That won't work at all. Everybody's just going to look at it as a totally disjointed thing, and nobody's going to get much out of it. So what you want to do, you'll have 20 minutes. You want to make a coherent presentation on that topic. Having said that, you have a lot of freedom. A number of these topics are very broad. Okay, you could do. We were talking about lasers earlier. So lasers, for example, was it lasers? Or no, which one was it? It was superconductivity. Okay, that also can be very broad. You can do a lot of things with superconductivity. Okay, it's easy to fill 20 minutes on any one of those, so you have to be a little bit selective. Having said that, there's one student who is in the superconductivity group who is actually interested in working on particle detectors, particle accelerators, which wasn't a group that formed, but you surely do have particle accelerators and particle detectors that have superconducting magnets. So it's completely reasonable for that group to have a piece of their presentation be applications of superconductivity, and have that be a piece on particle accelerators and detectors, right? So that you have a lot of freedom to try to make it what you as a group want it to be, satisfying some individuals, but just keep in mind that you want it to be basically coherent. And I mean, when I'm in the audience and somebody is up here, if they give a disjointed presentation, or if they give it way over your head or way beneath you, and it can be a student, it can be the most senior professor or administrator at the university, if they're way up here, way down here, or disjointed, it just pisses me off personally. Because I'm thinking, why is it you cannot just picture what it looks like from the audience? Put yourself in the shoes of your audience. That is the single rule about making presentations professionally, making arguments to your boss, or whatever. It doesn't actually matter what you think or what you say. if you're way up here, way down here, you have to step back and say, what does it look like to them? All right, and that's what I want you to be thinking as you try to cobble this together. Not just, what is it I want to do? I mean, I'm fine if you want to do that, but in the end, this project is not only for you to, I mean, I'm wanting you to have fun, pick topics that you're going to have fun with, and have fun exploring them and learning in that process, but then I want you to actually teach the class something about that project, which means you've got to pitch it at the right level. You need to make it sort of fun, you need to make it coherent, okay? And always think, what does this look like to your audience? If you get up here and you have beautiful embedded movies that don't work on the AV, you look like an idiot. And it happens. Okay? It happens in these projects sometimes. It happens to faculty members. It happens at international conferences. And invariably, you look like an idiot. So, okay? Any questions on this? So I sent out the note giving the breakdown of the topics, and a few of you should check it out and send me which groups you want to be in, because I didn't know that. All right, so to start out today, we're going to... is anybody like a NASCAR fan in here? Nobody? How about horse racing? No? Okay. Does anybody just want to help with a demo? All right, you two. You are?
Andrew.
Come on up. I need two. Andrew, I'm going to hand you something. Describe that for the class. And you are?
Ethan
and Andrew.
Covered in tape. It's got little plastic bits on him.
Yeah.
And little washers around here. Some masking tape from down the side.
Okay, so it's like this little pellet thing. And what I need is, somebody have a watch with a second hand?
A stopwatch.
I've got one.
A stopwatch. All right. And you've got good reflexes, right? All right, so what Andrew and Ethan are going to do is they are going to take these pellets and they are going to allow them to feel the force of gravity, and nature will take its course. So they are going to take the pellets and place them up here, tell you when, and they're going to drop them. When the pellets hit, they're going to hit some sort of metal down here that's going to make a racket. And I want you to try to, as best you can, track the time. Okay? I know this isn't a mechanics class, but we'll get there. So, Andrew, go first.
Straight down the tube?
Yeah, you just want to release it. Don't throw it. So we're looking at gravity here.
Ready? 3, 2, 1, go.
Okay. All right.
Second time wouldn't have helped.
All right. That was okay. So, Ethan.
Ready? 3, 2, 1, go.
All right. All right. Now, describe this tube to the class.
Well, it's hollow.
It's hollow.
Plastic. There's not much.
PVC.
Yeah, okay. So now we're going to do a test on the material dependence of gravity. Describe this one. Oops.
It's also hollow. It's aluminum.
Don't drop it.
Yeah.
Please.
All right, you ready? Go again.
3, 2, 1, go.
8:45.
What are you doing?
Did you forget how to do it?
Did you turn off gravity?
He turned off gravity.
Maybe gravity is materially dependent here.
Ready?
Well, we're going to see.
1, 2, 3, go. That's right. I'm better at this.
All right, Andrew, one more try. See if you learn anything watching your colleague there.
3, 2, 1, go.
Should I put mine through there?
Okay. Andrew, yours has an embedded magnet. Ethan's does not. It's just a piece of aluminum. Does that bother you a little bit? All right, give them a hand. Thanks, guys. It is aluminum. Okay, that's a plastic one. That's an aluminum one. One of them has a magnet. That's the slow one in the aluminum. And then the other doesn't. Okay? So clearly, there's some weirdness in this world, right? So we will talk about that. All right, so at the start of class last time, or at the end of class last time, we started talking about induction. And just to remind you, back in magnetostatics, we looked at circuits. And in the circuits, we asked, what is the change in the potential, or how much work per unit charge does it take to go around in a closed loop? Okay, and the answer is it's always going to be zero. You may gain energy or lose energy as you go through different parts of the circuit, but as you come back to the same point, the sum of all the energy gains and losses is zero if you don't have, well, period. And so if we were to take Kirchhoff's law and sort of imagine doing it in free space, you can cast it that way, and you can make a loop that you go around, and basically Kirchhoff's law in free space is the integral of E dot dl is zero. Right? That's as you go around, the total electric field integral that you see is zero. So in some places it may work against it, some place it may work for you or whatever. It's not to say the electric field is zero everywhere, but the integral of E dot dl is zero. So that's basically a statement that the electric field is a conservative field. So if we're in a world where the magnetic field is changing, then it doesn't work that way. In fact, when you go around the loop, because we saw this actually in the demos where if we have a loop of wire and we take a magnet and put it through it, what we're doing is we're taking a magnetic field and it's changing through that loop, okay? So, and what we found was that we actually got an induced voltage, which is basically saying this is not zero anymore. And so what's happening is you have a changing magnetic field, and it makes the integral of E dot dl not zero around that loop. So there's a new law that we have here, and we say that we have an induced EMF, and it's the integral of E dot dl within a loop, and it depends on the changing magnetic field. So this phi sub m is the magnetic flux through that loop, and you have a non-zero induced EMF if you have a changing magnetic flux. If I stopped the magnet in the middle of the loop, there's a magnetic field going through the loop, but it's no longer changing. And the induced EMF went to zero. And then if I pulled it out, all of a sudden we had an induced EMF. So it's the change in the magnetic flux that's relevant for inducing the EMF. And this is true in material. We actually saw it in a wire where we were measuring something. But actually what's really neat about this, as we'll see later on, it becomes more and more important, is that this is true also in free space. Okay. So this is known as induction. Now, there's this weird minus sign here, and so there's some thinking that we have to do to figure out about the size of the induction or the direction of the induction. So I have the rule that you need to remember written out here. This is a repeat of what I had on the other page where phi m is the magnetic flux, which you calculate in exactly the same way you've done electric flux, but it's through the surface. It's through the surface that is subtended by the circumference of your loop, whatever its shape. I say circumference as if it's a circle, but it could be any shape loop. Think of it as in a plane, though. I think that's probably the best way to do it. So you get this induced EMF. What direction is the induced EMF? That's actually the tricky part here. And in order to figure that out, always go back to Lenz's law, which is written here. Lenz's law says that an induced current in a closed conducting loop will appear in such a way as to oppose the change that created it, which I think sounds sort of opaque. It's a little bit like when you were learning about buoyancy, you always go back to the definition, which is the buoyant force is equal to the weight of the displaced water. If somehow you're doing these mechanics problems in fluids and you don't always go back to that core statement, you just get in trouble all the time because the intuition you can lose. The same is sort of true here. This basically in these problems should just be a mantra in every problem. Yeah.
So if the EMF over a closed loop isn't zero, can the particle just like gain energy till infinity if it goes around in a circle? Or does like the internal resistance of
The answer is yes. I mean, if you have a changing magnetic flux in the system inducing an EMF, you can accelerate a particle that way.
Perfect.
Yeah. In fact, there are particle accelerators that are constructed to do that are on that very principle. Kirchhoff's law, yeah, Kirchhoff's law really refers to the magnetostatic or the system. I mean, that's where it's equal to zero. But yeah, when you have changing fields, induction takes place, and you can accelerate by induction. You might say that that's breaking conservation of energy, but it's not because there's work happening in changing this field. Okay. All right, so I think Lenz's law is one of these things that's a little bit fuzzy until you actually look at some examples. So let me look at a couple of examples. I forgot to complain about the lack of a projector in here. Okay, so let us we have a loop, okay? And let us imagine that in this loop we have a magnetic field and that B is increasing in strength. All right. What would be the direction of the induced current in the loop? Here's how to think about it. All right. The field is coming out and it is getting stronger. Because it's getting stronger, you have a changing magnetic flux. So you will have induction happening. There will be an induced current in this wire. Okay? Lenz's law says that current that is induced due to this induction will be in a direction such that it fights the change that created it. So, this field is getting stronger. If the field is getting stronger on the inside, then you want to induce a current that will reduce the field on the inside. So if the field is getting stronger coming out, you will induce a current clockwise, because that current will create in and of itself a magnetic field that is going in and fights the change that created it.
What does it do?
Okay, the question is why? I'm trying to think if there's an easy way to... give me a second here, sorry. That's a good question, and I think I can even answer it, but I have to think for a moment about how to answer it nicely. If you imagine having a solenoid... We know that if you have a current in a solenoid, you have a magnetic field going through it, okay? Magnetic field, we also know, we haven't established yet, a magnetic field, like an electric field, has an energy density in it, okay? So let us imagine that we have just a solenoid, there is no current going through it. Then there is no magnetic field. Now, we start to put a current through it. But because we do that, we will be going from zero magnetic field to some other magnetic field to establish that field. That's got to take work. So, I mean, imagine it's a superconductor. You're not actually losing energy in the conductor. So what happens? Basically, it's an energy sort of thing. It's like the system fights you. That means you have to work to establish those fields, I guess is sort of how I think about it. In the end, you win, but it takes work to do it. Have you ever noticed that... if the compressor motor in a refrigerator turns on or turns off, if you're in a house that's maybe a little old, it dims the lights. This is an induction phenomenon. I mean, because what's happening is all of a sudden you're trying to start this motor going, and to do that you're shoving current through a lot of loops and everything, and so basically you get a backwards EMF coming from the system because of Lenz's law. And when that happens, it'll actually reduce the voltage in the house a little bit, and you'll get a drop in the light.
Do older air conditioners do that too?
Oh yeah. Anything that's got some motor. I mean, you don't notice it so much in new houses, and I'm not quite sure what they do to really prevent it, but I think it has to do with the way the wiring is set up and everything. But you definitely notice it in cars, if you have when you crank the starter motor and you have the lights on, I mean, basically, a lot of the power is going to get the motor started, and the lights will dim and everything. So these are induction phenomena. All right, so there is one. Let's think our way through a different one. Let's say that. We have a uniform magnetic field in this region, and I have a rectangular loop of wire which we are removing with a velocity v. Okay? And I'd like to know whether we have a clockwise induced current relative to you, a counterclockwise induced current, or no induced current. So think about that for a moment, and then we'll take a vote. So we have a uniform magnetic field that is into the board, and this rectangular loop, which is a closed loop, is being pulled out at velocity v. Okay, close your eyes. Well, decide which one you think it is, one, two, or three. Close your eyes. All who think that the current will be clockwise, raise your hand. Counterclockwise, and no current. All right, so we have a few more for clockwise than counterclockwise or no induced current. It's almost split between counterclockwise and no induced current. Okay? So, for one of you who thinks it's clockwise, tell me why. Rachel?
Since the wire is being moved out of the magnetic field, in effect, the magnetic field is decreasing inwards, so you increase inwards, and by the right angle, it goes clockwise.
Okay, so Rachel says as the loop is being moved out, you're decreasing the amount of magnetic field in the loop, so you're decreasing the magnetic flux with time. So you want to induce a current in such a way that it increases the magnetic flux through the loop. That would be in accordance with Lenz's law. And that, by the right-hand rule, would be clockwise current. Okay? And that's the right logic in this. So I would guess if you said no induced current, you're thinking, well, the field strength isn't changing. But it's the change in the flux through the loop that's important. And that is changing because the area that the magnetic field is in is changing. Okay? So there are sort of two types of problems you'll see typically here. One is where you have some loop and the field strength is changing in some way or form. And the other is where the loop is changing, either being yanked out of the circuit or is being changing in size or something. So that if the loop were being, yes.
If you had a superconducting loop and you moved a magnet into it and induced a current, would it keep going forever, assuming that there's no further change in the magnetic field? But does it die because of resistance, or does it die because the magnetic field is no longer changing?
Flux is zero.
But you already now have a current going, so there's no opposing.
But it's dependent on the change of flux. If the flux doesn't change, that is
the current. Well, there isn't an EMF.
But if you have resistance, it would keep on going.
So if you had a superconductor that had changing magnetic.
That's a really good question.
Yeah. Really good.
I'm not really sure. I think you would induce the current and it would persist.
Yeah. And then when you pull it out, it would be zero.
Yeah. I mean, when you pull it out, you'd be fighting that. So, I mean, there's...
You would just cease it at the same rate that you start.
I mean, you've done the work to produce the current, but it's... Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not really sure. The other thing is you can sometimes get some weirdness with magnetic fields and superconductors. Magnetic fields actually don't penetrate into superconductors, which may actually do something weird with this. I have never thought about this. That's a really good question. I'll have to
do that.
Yeah, I'll have to ask around. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know for sure. Yeah, good. Okay. So no more questions for you, Ethan. Yes.
A really big magnetic field just that kept going out a lot farther than this loop, and you were just pulling it through the constant magnetic field and not out of it.
Another absolutely excellent question. The question was, if you have a uniform magnetic field, very big, and you just have this loop going across, does that do something? I do know that if you have a wire like this and you sweep it in a magnetic field that's uniform, you will get an induced EMF across it. So that's not so different. Now, do you get the induced EMF if you have just the loop? The areas stay the same. I'll have to get back to you on that. I've forgotten. That comes up a lot. It can be very confusing. The one that I just told you, you'll see in a problem. But you actually have to think of it in a way that's a little different from what we're used to, because you don't have the loop to sit there as this thing sweeps out some space. So this Lenz's law, this whole picture that I'm painting, is a little harder to think your way through when you have that kind of situation. So, can't answer it well right now, but let me think about that. Yes?
I have a question about his question.
Okay.
So, if you have the current outside of the loop, then you would have the magnetic field going into the loop, right?
If you have the current outside of the loop.
Yeah, you have, okay, so you've like pulled the loop outside of the magnetic field, so you have the current going.
Yes.
And it would produce a magnetic field inwards, right?
Yes.
And so since there's a current, there's a magnetic flux.
Yes.
Inwards. So then by Lenz's law, shouldn't there be an induced current going the opposite direction that would oppose it and eventually cause it to cancel?
It's only a change in magnetic flux, though.
But the change is
right, so you're saying that as you pull this out, you'll get an induced current which is fighting this. It slows things down. But as you pull this thing out, you get an induced current.
Yeah, once the loop is outside.
Well, once the loop is outside, if it's conventional, you'll certainly have nothing. If it's a superconductor, I mean, I'm not sure that you actually get anything because of the magnetic field not penetrating in the superconductor, but still the flux would be there. So, I mean, I'm not actually sure, so sorry about that. But let's assume for a moment it does induce one. It does reduce the d phi dt, so it does actually change. I mean, there is something known as self-inductance, so yes, there is an effect. But in the end, you would still have the change of the field from pulling it out will be the dominant piece. So what you find with these induction things is that when you're establishing the current, it slows things down. It acts a lot like a resistance, actually. It just sort of slows things down. And then, and we'll get into that when we get into AC, because you can imagine an AC circuit is one where the EMF that you have is constantly changing. So you're going to have effects due to induction just out the wazoo in AC circuits. Okay. Wow, you guys. I normally say you should drink a shot of espresso or tequila before you come to class. It looks like somebody did. Three somebodies. Now, those are good questions. So, in fact, let me just look at this. Loop pulling out with uniform field. Just to try to jog my mind to think about those and get back to you on that. All right. So, that's induction. And we're going to be doing a lot with induction. So, let me do a standard problem. So everything we've done so far has been qualitative. What I'd like to do now is to actually do something more quantitative. So let me give you a different example of a geometry that you sometimes will see, which is where we have a rectangular loop with an ammeter put in it. So you can measure the current. And we're going to have a conducting bar. So what happens is this bar can slide on these conductors frictionlessly, and then we're going to have it happening in a region where we have a uniform magnetic field. So that's one geometry you'll sometimes see, okay? So what's happening here, if this bar is moving, then you're going to be changing the flux in this, so you can calculate that. Sometimes you'll get questions that talk about if you have a certain resistance, what voltage gets developed across here. So the way to do that is to figure out what the induced EMF is, and then from that, actually they'll ask you what's the current. So the induced EMF basically gives you the voltage, and then you have a resistor here, and that'll determine the current. So there are different ways to do this. You'll be, if you have a current going through a resistor, you lose energy, so you have to exert a force in order to move this thing. So that's a pretty standard geometry. Let me do a quantitative problem, though. So let's take a uniform magnetic field into the board, and let's take our rectangular loop that we had a little while ago. Let's say that it has side this way of length L, and at a given moment that we're looking at it, it has a length X which is inside the field. And if we then say that it's being pulled out with a velocity V, okay, the direction of the induced current is going to be what we saw a little while ago. You're pulling it out, so that reduces the field strength going through it, reduces the amount of field going through it, so you're reducing the flux. So you want to increase the flux in the direction of the field, which means the current is going to go clockwise. And the induced EMF, the size of it, is minus d phi m over dt. The minus sign really here really gives you this direction. That is the mathematical way of saying Lenz's law. That's what it's about. So typically the way I do this is I don't worry about the minus sign. I calculate the magnitude of the induced EMF, and I use the thinking, qualitative thinking, to know what direction it is. Because somehow if you try to just use this minus sign and figure it out, it just never quite works. It's a little bit, I don't know, when I'm doing energy conservation problems in mechanics, I sort of do it the same way. I always start, well, I have this thing moving, and then that energy turns into gravitational potential energy, or the kinetic energy slows down. So I sort of think of the energy flow, whereas if I try to go back and use the equation where the change in external energy is equal to the change in kinetic energy and the change in potential energy, I just find I get all confused with the signs. I mean, it always screws me up. So I always just think about energy flow. So here, I find that it's better to actually not pay attention to the sign, just do the magnitude, and then use the qualitative reasoning to decide what the direction is. But that's what the minus sign is about. So the magnetic flux at this moment is going to be X times L times B. So that's going to be the magnitude of B times the area that's currently in the field. And now it's moving at velocity V. So L isn't changing with time, B isn't changing with time, so you can move those out, and this becomes dx over dt, which is V. So the induced EMF in magnitude is BLV. We can go ahead and keep the minus sign. If we happen to throw a resistor in here, and then you can solve, that's the induced EMF, then the current, because V is equal to I times R, and we've just solved for V, or the induced EMF, even though it's not across a battery, you can think of it the same way. So I is going to be the induced EMF over R, or BLV over R. Okay? So, yes?
What
What if it was free space and there was no resisting?
Well, if it's free space, you're not going to have a current.
What if there was no resistor? Is it just by nature of the wire that there's internal resistance?
Yeah, I mean, well, no, and you could put a resistor in the wire.
But what if there wasn't one?
If there's no wire there, nothing's going to happen unless you have charge there, and then charge will move because basically this process is, if I have a changing magnetic field, I will have a changing electric field in the region. And so if we had a plasma, for example, of charged particles, they'll move. And you might have resistive heating of some form in a gas. I don't know about that. Boy, this is a bad day. Lots to think about. All right. So let us imagine that we have a solenoid. And that we have a constant I in here. The solenoid has n turns per unit length. And let's say each turn has area A. All right. Then the magnetic flux through this thing is going to be the magnetic field strength, that whatever you have in this thing, times the area. And we've already calculated what the magnetic field in a solenoid is. Looks like I've lost my... And conveniently, I have one battery when I need two, so sorry about that. Get the right mic. All right, so the magnetic field for a solenoid we've calculated, remember that was one which is uniform, it's mu zero times n times I. So this is mu zero times n times I times the area is going to be the magnetic flux through the solenoid itself. You have these multiple loops, so you have to have... I'm sorry, this is through a single turn. All right, because you have a certain magnetic field that's going through the solenoid, and if I ask what is the flux through a single turn, it's going to be that field, which is mu zero n times I, times the area of that single turn of the solenoid. Okay? So if we have length L of the solenoid, then the total flux is going to be the flux through a single turn times the number of turns you have in the length L, which is going to be N times L. So mu zero times N times I times A, this is phi M through a single turn. And then you need to multiply that by the number of turns that you have in a length L, which is going to be the length L times the number of turns per unit length. So that this total thing is phi M through length L of the solenoid. You okay with that? Yes?
Why are there two N's? Wouldn't the N times L give you the total number of loops?
N times L gives you the total number of loops in a length of a solenoid.
Then why is it B not NIA?
Because this is the field strength in the solenoid, and that does depend on the turn density.
Okay.
And I told you no more questions today, right? Okay. So you do get the n squared in here. All right. So this is the phi m that you have in some length L of the solenoid, and what one of the things I want you to notice in this is that even through this single turn, phi m is proportional to the current in this phi m also is proportional to the current. Okay? So we can say that phi m in the system is proportional to the current, and we're going to give it a constant of proportionality, which is L. And L here we're going to call the constant of self-inductance. So this poor solenoid doesn't have a date, and it has to sit there and talk to itself. So that's what's happening here. The magnetic flux through the solenoid depends on the current in itself. Okay? So that's what this quantifies. L here is a measure of the geometry. So if we have the solenoid that has a certain length, a number of turns per unit length in a cross-sectional area A, then L, this constant of self-inductance, is going to be mu zero times n squared times L times A. Depends on the length, depends on the cross-sectional area, and depends on the number of turns per unit length. Those are all geometric quantities. If I change any of them, I change its self-inductance. I change its ability to talk to itself, I guess, as a way of thinking about it. Okay? So where this becomes relevant is, suppose I now decide to change I. If I change I, then I'm going to change phi. And if I change phi, then I get a non-zero d phi m over dt, which gives me an induced EMF. All right. So now what this says is, in this poor little solenoid, if I change the current, I get an induced EMF in the loops of the solenoid, flat out. So it fights itself, right? So it's going to try to have an induced EMF that actually will create a field that goes in the opposite direction of the one that's being established by the changing I, and so it'll sort of fight the change. Yes?
Does the field, like, in effect, completely delete does the resisting field completely delete the friction?
No, it won't completely delete it. It fights it, but it doesn't delete it. It doesn't go to zero. So the induced EMF, we know, is minus d phi m over dt, and we've defined phi m as L times I, so this is minus L di over dt. And in fact, for a solenoid or anything really, we have this equation, which is the induced EMF is proportional to the change in the current. And that constant of proportionality is this quantity L, which depends only on geometry. We call, in this case, we're calling it the self-inductance because it's a measure of how this thing talks to itself, and this inductance has units of Henry's, which may sound ridiculous, but you may recall that Joseph Henry is a physicist who did some nice work early on. That's the MKS unit. Okay? All right, now just to make life complicated, just as in in real life, you cannot have a date for Saturday night. Or maybe you have a date for Saturday night. If you don't have a date for Saturday night, you're talking to yourself. If you do have a date for Saturday night, you've got somebody else to talk to, okay? So we're now going to look at the more social of our solenoids. So in this one, we now have some sort of constant I. And let's say that we'll call this solenoid 1, and then we'll have another solenoid, or just for simpler, let's just say I have a wire loop here, which I call 2. And now you can see that if I have a changing current here, I mean, we know if I have a current in a solenoid, I have a field, which is mu 0 times n times I, so I'll have a field that will penetrate through this wire loop, number 2, and if I change this current, I will change the flux through number 2, and that will induce an EMF in number 2. So this thing will talk to that thing, okay? And we will call that, we'll have a very similar sort of analysis. So if we change, call this small case I, so things don't get confusing here. If we change I in number 1, then this gives me a changing phi m in number 2, and that induces an EMF in 2. All right, so if we get quantitative with that, the phi m in number 2 is going to be proportional to the current. In 1, right? If I have a small current here, I have a small field penetrating number 2, so I'll have a small phi m in number 2. If I have a big field here, I'll have a big field through number 2, which will give me a large phi m, okay? So phi m in number 2 here is going to be proportional to the current in number 1. And that means that phi m in 2 is equal to L times I in 1. Sometimes books will give this a different symbol, like an M, because what I'm doing here is this thing is now the constant of mutual inductance. All right, so this is where one piece of the system is talking to the other piece of the system, and you quantify it by the degree to which this piece talks to that piece is proportional to this quantity, either L or M, and I forget what your book uses, and it's proportional to this current, right? But given a current, how much phi m you have here will depend on the geometry of these two things, right? And so L here quantifies that. So the EMF in 2 is equal to minus L di 1 over dt, and the other way around. This is, there's a geometric association between these two pieces of the circuit, or two pieces of whatever it is. And it basically quantifies how much they talk to one another. And if you are talking about a changing current in this one and asking what it does to that one, you get the same constant of proportionality if you're talking about this one and you ask what does it do to the other one. Okay? It's the same geometric association. Any question? Yes?
So, change in I in the solenoid, like
If you change this, yeah, so you now have to be careful what you're asking about. It's a little bit like a mechanics work problem where the answer depends on, are you asking how much work do I do on the system, how much work is done by the system, et cetera. So you have to now ask, what is it you're actually after? And if you are asking, what does a change in current here do to that, then you think of it in this way. If you're asking about this, yes, it's true. There will be a constant of self-inductance for this piece with itself, but that's a different constant. Okay? So you're quantifying the relationship of this to that with the mutual inductance and of this with itself for the self-inductance. So you would have two different constants there. If I had another loop out here, the geometry would be different and its mutual inductance constant would be different between those. Okay, so now if you think about this for a moment, you can't make a circuit without it having inductance. Here's a wire loop with a battery in it. It's got to have a self-inductance, right? You cannot avoid that. And depending on the geometry, it may have a big self-inductance. If you have a piece of the circuit over here, it's going to talk to a piece of the circuit over here because the magnetic field's going to go all over the place. You might try to reduce it. Okay, but there's, so you can't really avoid this. And in fact, we're going to find you can even use it. And in fact, what you often try to do, I mean, it's not good if you're building a circuit and you literally have this piece talking to this piece over here. So one of the ways around that is to sort of have within the circuit built, well, I don't know if this really works around it, but one of the things you do is you can actually put pieces in the circuit that have a very large inductance, which are sort of put in the circuit in particular places, and those often will end up dominating. So you can think of them as within the circuit actually placing a little solenoid. So what I'd like to do is to think about that for a moment. And it's going to give us a chance to talk about energy and the magnetic field. So we're going to add a circuit element. Suppose we have a battery, and we connect that battery to a wire that connects across a resistor. And now we put a little solenoid in the circuit. Guess I can probably draw that better. This is called an inductor, and it's now a circuit element. You can think of it as a little solenoid that's actually put in the circuit. Now, it may be that this circuit has a self-inductance, but generally, unless told otherwise, you can assume that all that inductance is actually put here. Okay, so this is where, just like you might have a little resistance in the wire, but typically you put a resistor in the circuit and you think of all that resistance there, and unless you're specifically told otherwise, you think of the wire as not having resistance. All right, so in this problem, we know that Kirchhoff's law is true, so if we do the sum of the voltage drops, we get zero. So as we go around, we get that the EMF from the battery, and then we have a voltage drop across the resistor, and then we say that we have an induced EMF due to the inductor, which is going to be proportional to the rate of change of the current. So we have minus L di over dt. So that is the voltage drop across the inductor in this case. And this is equal to zero. So the EMF is equal to IR plus L di over dt. So now let's take this, and I want to multiply this by I, so we get EI is equal to I squared R plus L I DI over DT. Can you tell me anything about this term or that term?
Power.
Right. This is the form of power loss in a resistor. This is form of the power output of the EMF. Right? So we have this equation. This is a power term. This is a power term. This is going to be a power term. You can think of this power term as the rate at which work is done to create the magnetic field that is in that inductor. So it's the work that it takes to establish this field. So this is power as well. And so this is going to be the rate of change of the energy in the B field of the inductor, because nothing else is happening. So if we ask then, if we define UB as the energy stored in the magnetic field, then what we have just discovered is that the rate of change of that energy has the form of L times I times DI over DT. So I can now, basically the DTs cancel out. You have this dUB is equal to LIDI. And now what I'd like to do is, suppose I start by increasing the current from 0 up to I. So let's let I go from 0 up to big I. Okay? Then if we ask how much work is done to create the field that's there with a current big I in the solenoid or in the inductor, UB is going to be equal to the integral from 0 to big I of LI times DI, which is going to be LI squared, L big I squared over 2, right? Or 1/2 LI squared. So what we've just said is that UB then is going to be the amount of energy in the field of this solenoid or this inductor, if you want to think about it, right? If that's true, then you can think of this analogous to what we had with the capacitor. The energy in a capacitor was equal to 1/2 CV squared, if you remember. So this is sort of the analogous thing for the magnetic field. So you can think of this inductor as like a solenoid. So what I'd like to do is to actually look at a solenoid and see if we can find out something about the energy density in the magnetic field. So let's consider a special case, which is a solenoid. See, this is true for any inductor. It doesn't matter what the shape is. It doesn't have to be a solenoid. That's a conventional way of thinking about an inductor. But if you have a little circuit element, an inductor, if you have a certain inductance in a circuit, L, then you can calculate the energy that it takes to, you can calculate the energy it takes with a given current I to sort of power it up if you want, and that goes as 1/2 Li squared. All right, so we know we have a solenoid, so we have mu 0 times N times I, which is inside the solenoid, and we know that the B field is 0 outside. And let's say that this solenoid has a current I, it has n turns per unit length, and it has length L. All right, and we're going to assume that even though that this is true, even though we say it just has length L, okay, that let's sort of think of its length as being long relative to what we're looking at inside. And I want to define this sort of mu B to be the energy density in the electric, in the magnetic field. So an energy density is going to be the total energy divided by the volume in which you have it. So this is going to be the energy in the magnetic field divided by the area of the solenoid times the length that you're considering. So this is going to be 1/2 times L times I squared over A times L. And remember that we already established what the self-inductance was for a solenoid geometrically. So this becomes 1/2 times this n squared mu 0 L times A, if we did it right. This piece is from earlier. It's the self-inductance of a solenoid. And then we have an I squared over 2 times the area times the length L. So the energy density in the magnetic field is going to be 1/2 times mu 0 times I squared n squared, if I did the algebra right. But mu 0 times I times n is the magnetic field itself. So this is equal to the magnetic field in the solenoid strength squared divided by 2 mu 0. Because remember that B is equal to mu 0 times n times I. So that's what comes into that step. So what we have just found is that the energy density in a magnetic field depends on the square of the field divided by 2 times the permeability of free space. There's nothing in this that has anything to do with the geometry we picked out, the fact that it was a solenoid. It has only to do with B. So the energy density in a magnetic field depends on the strength of the magnetic field, the square of it. So just like with the electric field, we had a very similar thing. So this is, you know, there's energy that's actually stored in the magnetic field in an inductor. Do you have a question? Yep, there is. I think. Okay. All right, so the idea with these fields is that we sort of invent them as a calculational convenience. It's sort of powerful to be able to think about a condition in space as opposed to whatever is creating it. And that's literally pulled out of thin air. And now you take this concept and you run with it, and we're starting to realize that it's almost like there's some reality to this thing, right? Because now we're attributing energy to this electric field and to the magnetic field individually, just in and of themselves. So there's nothing wrong with playing pretend in science and looking to see where it goes, but this is an example of that where you sort of pull the fields out of thin air and then you run with them and see what happens. So just to remind you, for the electric field, mu sub E is equal to epsilon naught over 2 times E squared. So they're very similar in form. All right. Any questions on this? Okay, so that's a good place to stop. Yes, I'll have to do that demo next time. Sorry. All right. Have a good weekend.
But we will not forget that.